We have begun the practice, temporarily at least, of me using this time for announcements for those along the tape program as well as the local church. However, I have already heard from some of our number who would prefer to go back to the Bible study format, so we'll probably be kicking that around a little while and hearing from the rest of you. By the way, I did get one telephone call, so if anyone else in a local congregation would really prefer to go back to the Bible study format, please let the ministry know, and then we can be talking it over and seeing how to adjust that with the tape program and make sure that they receive the maximum benefit from the time we stand up here in this pulpit. I wanted to give you a brief report. The incoming mail volume is 22% above the same period for 1988. The first class returns from the letter offering the tape, the Jesus Christ tape, as it was called. Yeah, I think you got that letter. Was 22% return, which is 1.5% above average. The third class letter returns from the one offering When God Shakes the Earth was 14%, which is 1.5% above the average. I did a weekly TV program on Wednesday. The topic was Born Again and Tongues, and that will be recorded, I should say aired, on most stations a week from this coming Saturday, I believe. The new white mail this week was 261, and total letters, 2,878. We had only around 650 or 700, I think, telephonic responses last week. It was somewhat down, but we have a new procedure, so I didn't get the exact number because they are now entering them directly into the computer on the terminals rather than doing it by hand. And next week we'll have an accurate count for you. The international news went to press on Friday, the 17th of February, and last week we sent out 4,786 tapes in a tape program. Ian has given me a few letters excerpts, and I'll read just a few of them to you. Dear sir, as I listened to your program, I realized how little I knew about the kingdom of God and the real gospel. I have listened to the evangelists, or showmen, if you will. Yes, I will. And sometimes the message gives me faith, other times nothing. I would like to receive a copy of What is the Kingdom of God and What is the Real Gospel. Another one, I am a Worldwide Church of God member. I have been with them for over 25 years, and since you left, and then when your dad passed away, I can see things going downhill. Things are not like they used to be. We always loved to hear you and know you always spoke the truth. We always felt you were the backbone of the Worldwide Church of God, so we love to hear from you and get back on the right track again. Thank God I found you again. I don't know if this person means that we hope you get back on the right track, or that we're both on the right track, or we're in the right track going in the wrong direction, or the right train on the wrong track going in the right direction. But anyway, we're all back on the track, and we had better be back on the track. Anyway, there I go again. Another letter. Dear Mr. Armstrong, this morning I listened to your cause and effect tape. I was deeply impressed. May I ask, is there anything we as humans can do about the effects we reap in our physical bodies, even though the cause of these problems were our own doing before we came to a knowledge of cause and effect? And I guess they're talking about health. You have a list of booklets you offer, like Holidays, Pagan versus Real Truth, and so on. There's a little bit of a news excerpt, and I won't take time to go through all of that right now, having basically to do with Afghanistan. I'm working on an article for an upcoming issue of Watch Magazine from a book that has been scaring the daylights out of me called Yen, among other books I have on the resurgence of the Japanese Empire and what will be happening at the end of this 1 year of official mourning following the death of Emperor Hirohito, when his son Akihito goes behind the veil and is allegedly taken inside the womb of the sun goddess and then emerges not as a human but as divine. I was asking someone at lunch the other day, oh yeah, Gerald Dower, I said, do you know how big IBM is? And we were all agreeing that it was about 50-some thousand, I forget how many employees IBM is. Gigantic corporation. And I said, you know how big GMC is? We got talking about the size of GMC. And then how big is the Xerox Corporation? And how big that is in terms of billions of dollars per year and thousands of employees. And then how big is AT&T? Well, it's a gigantic corporation. And I said, you know which one corporation in Japan is bigger than all four of those put together? And he didn't know, and I told him it was Tokyo Tell and Tell. And there are several others that are bigger than GM or IBM, but there is one in Tokyo that is bigger than all four of those gigantic American corporations put together. The last week, Good Morning America has been spending about 20 minutes of each of its morning newscasts on an assessment of the differences between Japanese commerce, business, and industry, and that in the United States, and giving a lot of interesting statistics, which merely buttressed what I had been doing in my article and research that I had, including Herman Kahn's book called It wasn't the Japanese super giant, but the Japanese challenge or something of that nature, because I'd written an article some years earlier in 1960, Japan Future Super Giant. You may not remember Herman Kahn, but he was, and I think still is alive, was the chairman of the Hudson Think Institute. And such institutes, of course, hire hundreds of people. And they are like a vast data gathering, news gathering, information kind of a bureau, which includes every conceivable publication from around the world, foreign and otherwise, which includes the compiling of all historical data resulting from the occupation of Japan beginning in August of 1945, the war crimes trials involving so many of the leading Japanese generals and their politicians, all the reconstruction period during the MacArthur administration when he rewrote the Japanese Constitution, interviews by the thousands with Japanese people at every level, from those who ran the prison camps to those who were preeminent in the Navy or the Army or the Air Corps, people in the educational institutions in Japan, thousands of citizens, so on. So his book was really a sort of a compressed little compilation of data that was received from all over the world for literally decades. I would highly recommend it, though it may be out of print. Maybe I can find out where it was published and let you know, because as nothing else, it gives you an insight into the Japanese mentality that shows you the tendency of the individual Japanese to completely subjugate his own personal aspirations into the communal betterment or the communal whole, the civilization of which he is a part. And as one man said on Good Morning America, what am I supposed to do, go sing the GM fight song? Well, as I said to my wife, why not? But he was kind of getting on the Japanese because of what he knows they do. And I could read to you the words of, for example, only one corporate song that sounds like On Wisconsin, where thousands of Japanese gather in the parking lot for calisthenics at about 6 o'clock. And after about a half an hour of vigorous calisthenics, they all gather and they sing lustily at the top of their lungs a song, and in this one particular one it gives all the words translated into English, that we're going to go in there and we're going to produce this particular semiconductor or this particular high density television set or this transistor radio or this TV set or this bicycle or Suzuki or Honda, Toyota, whatever, and it'll be like a never ending stream gushing forth into all the world from Japan. We will flood the world with our goods. On Toyota, on Suzuki, or whatever. And they get all inspired and excited. They go charging off into the factory to work all day, 6 days a week, 60 hours a week, to save on the average 17% of their annual earnings to an American 4%. Our five-day work week has been seriously challenged. Many people would like it reduced to 4. They would like the work week reduced to below 40. It was 50-some when I got out of the Navy. They would like it now down to about 30 hours a week. Again and again and again, they pointed out to us that the American will always choose in favor of the short-term goal, and that indeed our tax structure in this country is so designed so as to ensure that corporate managers scramble to make the balance sheets look as good as possible to their investors each quarter as the quarterly government and business reports come out. Rather than being satisfied with a 2% or a 1.5% or a 3% per annum return over the span of 10 years, knowing that the cumulative effect of this is going to be far larger percentages downhill, in America, we are after the quick buck, the quick fix, the quick corporate rollover. It also pointed out these incredible leveraged buyouts, LBOs for short, which have been happening all over our industry, some of the huge, gigantic ones like R.J. Reynolds and Nabisco that we heard about, the largest buyout in history, or merger, where not a single additional biscuit is produced, not a single additional cigarette is rolled, which is probably a good thing, But what I'm saying is that in these leveraged buyouts, which are accomplished by a group of corporate raiders getting together with junk bonds, cheap money, at high risk from all kinds of lenders, which puts together a pot or a slush fund of money, they then come in, they take over the corporation. The idea that they're going to streamline it or fix it or whatever, the stock market goes crazy. A lot of deals are probably worked a little bit ahead of time. So a handful of people on the inside of these leveraged buyouts get enormously wealthy from stock market trading, which is all speculation. But not one new thing is produced. Production does not increase. Nothing goes up. Nothing happens. All is as before. It's just taking money from here and there and the other place and pooling it together and redistributing it elsewhere. And because this is happening in our country, and the deficits are ballooning, and the import-export balance is, as it was, totally out of balance, and the Japanese are now literally invading our country and have been for the last 30 years with very high-quality goods that are undercutting American goods, we are now literally in the hands of our creditors, who are the Japanese. We are the debtors. We are the largest debtor in the history of all of mankind. We owe more money to more nations than any other nation has ever owed. And the Japanese are the largest creditors, having gigantic surpluses. So that our economic future is in the hands of our former vanquished enemy. They have had a kind of a national esprit de corps that takes me back to the early days of Ambassador College, when our students in 1956, 58, 60, 61 all believed in the idea of a pioneering educational institution, and that we were training to be princes and kings and a special elite group to rule with Jesus Christ in the kingdom of God. And the dynamism of that concept that led us to study and to rake leaves and to take the garbage truck run or to dig ditches or clean toilets or play basketball or study in class with every bit of will and determination and strength that we had, and to try to outdo one another in rising early and prayer and study and meditation and Bible study and getting the grades and learning and studying and achieving a graduation or a degree in Ambassador College. There was a spirit of, call it like the West Point. We used to call it the West Point of the work, but there was an esprit de corps that we had that was almost electric. You could almost feel it. And as I read through this about the Japanese and their gigantic corporate industry having that same kind of a spirit of a loyalty to a company that we had to God and to God's Word and to God's college and so on, it is really awesome. And then I see that that is absent in the United States, that we have lived beyond our means. We've borrowed way too much. We've consumed way too much. We've bought way too much. We've produced way too little. And that today it's now too late. We are not going to make the changes required. The changes that they listed will not be done. We will not totally change the tax structure. We will not change all the taxes which would really increase an outpouring of capital goods and entrepreneurship and new people coming into industry and so on. Let me give you an example. They've been covering how now we are about, and we were mentioning this at lunch just a moment ago, that we are now about to be flooded with a gigantic breakthrough from the Japanese that they uniquely will market in the world, called high-density television, which is going to completely change the entire concept of both transmission and reception of television in this country. But the concept was developed by some Americans, an American firm. It was brought up to a particular point in its conceptual design and its original design stage by this same American group. But they lack the money because it isn't there, and because of the way we are structured in our economy and the tax laws and so on, to carry through with it. Because you got to have this long period of time where you've got a gigantic negative cash flow. All your cash is going out for investment and capital equipment and tooling up and employees and facilities and developing the marketplace. And you got to have a negative cash flow maybe for years before you get a positive cash flow. Then maybe it's years beyond that before it crosses over and you're showing a profit. And our structure is such that we're not willing to do that. So, like a microcosm of what's happening to the nation as a whole, the American firm that originally developed that concept sold it to the Japanese. Like Esau and a pot of lentils, there went the birthright of high-density television. The Japanese took this concept, they've now got it locked up, and they ran with it. And now, because they very selectively target a particular market, which is the United States for high-density TV, and they penetrate that market, we're going to see one of the most staggering blows to the American economy, the American television market, which will probably just disappear. It'll all be Japanese in the next very few years. So it's a fascinating thing that is occurring, coming from a quarter that I've been shouting about for 29 years without very much success of having anybody listen to me. But I can resurrect the article that was on the front page at a time of the Plain Truth magazine back in about 1960, if you would like to read it, when I said Japan, future supergiant, but nobody paid any attention to it one way or the other. But I am writing a very lengthy article on that subject right now that I think is going to really singe your hair, because I've been so low, it's almost put me down where I felt very heavy and very sad over what I've been reading in this book called Yen for the last couple of weeks. It is just so absolutely defeating to read. The solutions are there. I mean, the answers are there, but the knowledge that we're not going to achieve those solutions or listen to those answers is very defeating. The Congress will not. We've got a president now that wants to make these nice sounds. Everything that Reagan put in place is just fine. We'll just have a little more so. We'll just go right along. We'll cooperate. We'll have a hands-on management. And we won't change, we won't tax anybody, which is nonsense. If they don't get the revenue, they're not going to do anything about the deficit. And even though, you know, nobody wanted Dukakis, they wanted George Bush, at least Dukakis said that he would raise taxes. Well, if Bush doesn't, eventually the economy is going to collapse anyway, because those deficits cause interest rates to go soaring up. And I don't know how in the world the Japanese have managed to do it. You better admire the Japanese, or the trade war would have been much worse than it is, because for the last 3 to 5 years, with the gradual shrinkage of the dollar all the way down about 127-1 from 361 when I was over there in the Navy, they have had to take less and less profits and to cut their profits. And if you've noticed, Japanese products have risen only very slightly and some not at all, when they should have jumped by 30, 40, 50%, and they could have. But the Japanese were too smart to price themselves out of our markets, and so they've been taking giant cuts at home because the disparity between the yen and the dollar is what it is. And they want to keep the markets opening and the goods open and the goods pouring in, and so they have done so. I went to Sam's Warehouse on Friday, and it was sort of a stunning experience. I'd never been in there before, and practically everything I saw, from leather baseball gloves to refrigerators, was Japanese. Practically everything in there was from Japan or Taiwan or Korea or Hong Kong or Singapore, from leather shoes to, knives and forks to crockery and dishware to every kind of a game, to every video set I looked at, to video cams, to radios, transistors, cameras. I mean, just warehouse stacked to the ceiling with millions of dollars worth of goods and almost nothing made in America. So it's something for our people to watch and really be aware of, and I intend to make this a real shocking article coming up in 20th Century Watch magazine. But it's not just the common market in Europe that's going to hurt our economy and send America down the drain. It's also the Japanese. Well, that sounds like a lot of very, very bad news, but on the other hand, we're supposed to understand what it means about eventually entering a time of a great tribulation and then what happens thereafter. So it's only that we're going to be probably surprised by it. And that is surprising to me. When Pearl Harbor came along, we were so surprised, so shocked. And yet the information was there. If you read Tolan's book, of all the documentation, the radar people on the tip out there, the island, that actually saw the aircraft approaching and called their lieutenant, "Oh, it's nothing, it's probably some bombers," click. When you see the entire story, that the actual telegrams that arrived in the White House and went through the commercial system, the boy on the bicycle, to take it to a basket and sat there waiting to be read on Monday, when if it had been read and gotten immediately to the government offices, we would have known the Japanese were about to attack. When you read that story about while we slept, about that thick of thousands of documents that prove we should have known about Pearl Harbor, we should have known when Roosevelt tried to order the Japanese out of Indochina. We should have known when we froze Japanese assets in our banks. We should have known when we cut off raw materials in the form of scrap metal and ores and so on going to Japan to try to force them, using raw materials as a political weapon, to get out of Indochina. And they were a bicycle economy then as now. No natural resources, the storage of oil, meaning that in a wartime footing, they only had 1 year and one half to survive as a nation. Of course they're going to go to war. They had no recourse. Americans have a very limited view of the world. Most Americans don't even know much about the world. The average high school citizen doesn't even know where Japan is. Many of them put it in the Mediterranean. And they put a pin where Italy is or something. They can't find London on a map. And that's not just a few here and there. That's far too many that don't even understand geography. But they also don't understand very much about history, nor about geopolitics. Many Americans are very glad to see the communists withdrawing Afghanistan. And that just blows my mind in a way, because here we are now, the Bush administration is going to stick by the Mujahideen, and we're still sending all kinds of arms in there, and we're hoping the Mujahideen are going to overthrow the puppet government left behind by the Soviets. Where is Afghanistan? How would you feel if the Soviet Union were, at this point in time, sending all kinds of money and arms and TOW, anti-tank weapons, and handheld Stinger anti-aircraft missiles to the Mexicans? And our troops had been fighting in Mexico to keep Mexico from going communist, in this case. And we had lost 15,000 young Americans, and little by little it had become another Vietnam. We realized we can't win, and we withdraw. And we know that even though the Cold War is now thawing out, the Soviets are still supplying the Mexican insurgents with all kinds of sophisticated armor, and we're going to have right here in our backyard in Mexico a communist government looking down our throats. But see, because it's democracy, we want a democratic government in Afghanistan. So through Pakistan, we're filtering billions of dollars of weapons into the hands of the Mujahideen to overthrow a communist government on the border of the Soviet Union, where you would expect them to have a little bit of hegemony. We don't think of it from that point of view, do we? We don't put on the cap of the enemy and try to view it from his perspective that they had more right geopolitically to be in Afghanistan than we had a right to be in Vietnam. How far away is Vietnam from the United States? How far away is Afghanistan from Moscow? It's a neighboring country. It's just a perspective I'm talking about. Having nothing to do with justification, just talking about the way we tend to view our news and whether or not we are sitting there just taking in what the networks say and not using our minds and using rational thought as to how and why these things occur the way they do. Well, we are to watch, and so with that brief synopsis, I will sit down and we'll have another congregational song if you would like, and then I'll come back with a message. We all know the one main promise that is given to us for the kingdom of God is that we are to be kings and priests, rulers, co-rulers with Christ for 1,000 years. Revelation 2:26, to him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, Revelation 3:21, or Revelation 2:26, will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and they shall be broken in shivers, even as I received of my Father. For many, many decades, we heard sermons about rulership, about authority, about government, and especially about how to qualify. There must have been hundreds and hundreds of sermons on how to qualify to be a king. Christ had said to his disciples that they would sit on his right and his left hand, governing, ruling over the 12 tribes of Israel. on the very night of his, not the night of his crucifixion, but the night before his crucifixion, the night of the Passover, the famous Last Supper, the disciples were arguing about who was going to be greatest in the kingdom of God. And he had to rebuke them gently, and it must have hurt him very, very deeply to have that kind of an argument break out only within hours of his terrible beating and eventual crucifixion. But he was saying that it was not him to give or his to decide, but his Father had reserved that. But he did reassure them by saying, I tell you, you shall sit on 12 thrones judging the tribes of Israel. In another place, the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, talking about judging problems that went on in the church between brethren, taking difficulties that they couldn't handle to the ministry and so on, know you not that we shall judge angels? Now, it was bad enough to hear sermon after sermon, especially preached to housewives, people on fixed income with a little garden in the backyard of their mobile home, truck drivers, sheep herders, bay workers, concrete finishers, carpenters, laborers of every kind. You are to be busily qualifying to be a king and a priest. Sermon after sermon about what a king does. I've got notes in there. I've got fat notes, folder after folder after folder, of sermon notes that go back to 1955 and 6. If I can show them to you, they're just thick. I could probably have a stack that high. In those notes are certain sermon notes that I could go find where I reminded people of the way Queen Elizabeth II would have logically taught her first son, who recently has been visiting the United States, and say, now, you're different from other children. You are a prince, and your mother is a queen, and your father is the consort of the queen, and my father was the king of England, and you are someday going to be the king of England. So you're different, Charles. You're not like other boys. You cannot deport yourself in the same way as do other boys. And I remember very well using all of those analogies. I can't help but wonder how defeating that must have been to many, many people. Somebody in a day worker's job or somebody running a daycare center, merely a housewife and a mother, who was saying, how can I qualify? So to throw them a sop, I well remember a sermon my father giving about how a mother and a housewife was to rule over her kitchen. And she was to learn to rule by ruling over her pots and pans. So we had a little something for everybody. Everybody is to learn to rule. But you know, a lot of people, I think, were frustrated because I think they could hear all these marvelous sermons, and they get in their car, and they go back to their mobile home in the little carrot patch, and they're really wondering, what am I doing here that has anything to do with government? I mean, pick up a Time magazine or The Economist or some of these weekly news magazines, or they see the television set about some Senate committee investigating this or that. They see these people going to the Senate Armed Forces Committee or whatever, and how governmental decisions are made at the cabinet level, and they say, how could I ever do that? How could I solve the problems of criminal justice? How could I solve the problems of acid rain? How could I balance the federal budget? How could I get in there and understand the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act? How in the world am I supposed to ferret out all this stuff like during the investigation into the information that now is led to the trial of Oliver North? I mean, how could I sort that out and come to a decision and judge right from wrong? And I think secretly they felt, well, probably at the last instant, just as I jump into the office and I'm made into the very member of the family of God, magically, I'll receive all that knowledge, and all that information will just be given me by divine fiat, and instantly I will be qualified at that time to judge or to rule, even though privately we could acknowledge we're not qualified to judge or to rule today. George Bush has a lot of good friends, and some of those good friends go back a long way back to the good old crony days of the good old boys in Texas. One of them's name is John Tower, and Tower is the antithesis of his name. He is about that tall. I've met him over in Dallas, shook hands with him, and he comes about here on me. He's a very small little fellow, but apparently has a very big record and has a lot of things that they're now ferreting, you know, the ferrets are out and the FBI and other people are investigating, and he's really sweating a kind of a Senate hearing for confirmation over whether or not he is going to have a cabinet-level job. In order to show support for him, at the very first cabinet meeting that George Bush had, Tower sat right there at his right hand. And he is standing by his choice at the present time. What qualifications has he for Secretary of the Armed Forces and all of the power that that would connote, where he would really be over all of the admirals and the great generals and so on of all of our military establishments at the cabinet level, and would be like a Secretary of War, except now they call it Secretary of Defense? Well, we know what his background has been, what his record has been, but what specific qualifications does he have for that particular job? Actually, many Americans would say one of the real detracting things from that is that he has been a powerful consultant and, in fact, a lobbyist working for major defense contractors, helping them win government contracts, and now he will have to be in the guise of a policeman disciplining some of these former people who were paying him tens of thousands of dollars a year to get government contracts and ferreting out the wrongdoing and the people who were overcharging the government for wrong material, and where the famous rents that cost the Air Force $5,000 a copy or whatever it is, and some of this wastage that we're familiar with, and people are wondering whether or not John Tower can do that. If you were a very close personal friend of George Bush, and you had a college degree from Harvard in law, it's possible that even though you had practiced criminal law, or you were a prosecutor, or you were an attorney that spent most of your time in corporate law or whatever, that you might be selected to come to the White House and given a cabinet-level job having to do with welfare or housing or something that was just kind of close to something you'd done before. The junior class president of my junior class, the year behind me when I was a senior in Eugene High School, ended up as a cabinet-level officer, the Secretary of Commerce during the Ford administration. And I just thought of him as a kid that I knew driving a Model A Ford up and down the streets, and just another kid just like the rest of us, except beneath my notice because it was a year behind me. But he became a cabinet-level officer. Let me put to rest the worry that many people have about what it takes to qualify to be a king. Let's turn back to 1 Samuel. I want to show you a little bit about a man who became the very first king of Israel. 1 Samuel, about the 10th chapter, and we'll skip along through a couple or three of these so you can get a little bit of a feel of what happened during the reign of Saul. The Israelites all began to clamor for a king. They were tired of this system of judges, and even though Samuel thought they were rejecting him, God had to say, "They're not rejecting you, Samuel, but me." So it says in chapter 10 and verse 1 of 1 Samuel that Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, "Is it not because the Eternal has appointed you to be captain over his inheritance? When you're departed from me today, then you shall find two men by Rachel's sepulcher in the border of Benjamin at Zelzah, and they will say unto you, 'The asses which you went to seek are found, and lo, your father has left the care of the asses, and sorrows for you, saying, What shall I do for my son?' Then shall you go on forward from thence, and you shall come to the plain of Tabor," and he was to meet these people, "and they shall salute you," and so on. And he said, "The Spirit of God will come upon you," verse 6, "and you'll prophesy unto them, and you'll be turned to another man," and told him all these things were to happen. In verse 9, it was so that when he had turned back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all those times came to pass that day. And when they came thither to the hill, a company of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And it came to pass, when all that knew him before time had saw him, said, "Behold, he prophesies among the prophets," then the people said one to another, "What is this that is come unto the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" In the very first challenge that he had, the very first charge that he had from Samuel, he didn't quite carry it out to the letter the way he was supposed to. And so this terrible, embarrassing thing occurred to him. But one of the same place answered and said, "But who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" And when he had made it into prophesying, he came to the high place. And Saul's uncle said unto him and to his servant, Where did you go? They said, to seek the asses. And when we saw that they were nowhere, we came to Samuel. And Saul's uncle said, tell me, I pray you, what Samuel said. And Saul repeated it and told him that if the asses were found and so on, but the matter of the kingdom whereof Samuel spake, he told him not. And Samuel called the people together unto the Eternal to Mizpah, and said to the Israelites, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of all the kingdoms, and those that oppressed you. And you have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversaries and your tribulations, or adversities and tribulations, and you've said unto him, nay, but set a king over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Eternal by your tribes, and by your thousands. And when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, and apparently that may have taken a few days or even weeks, and they had a gigantic congregation standing there of representatives from all the tribes, that the tribe of Benjamin was taken, and when he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was taken, and Saul the son of Kish was taken. I take it that they were throwing lots, because that is the language that is used. And when they sought him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired of the Eternal further, if the man should yet come thither. And the Eternal answered, behold, he has hid himself among the baggage. And they ran and fetched him. And when he stood up among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders and upward. A very tall man, maybe 7 feet plus. And Samuel said to all the people, see ye him whom the Eternal has chosen, that there is none like him among all the people? And all the people shouted and said, God save the king. Then Samuel told the people the manner of the kingdom, and wrote it in a book, and laid it up before the Eternal. You'll see that that is explained a little bit later on. He showed exactly the kind of a man Saul would be, that taxation and military conscription, that the possession of their properties, that the nationalization of certain private businesses and so on would take place, and that they would be a little unhappy, eventually, with the king that they had insisted on having. Well, I won't read all of the rest of that chapter, but look at the 12th chapter for a moment. Samuel said to Israel, I have hearkened to your voice and all that you have said, and have made a king over you. Now behold, the king walks before you, and I'm old and gray-headed, and behold, my sons are with you, and I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day. Behold, here I am, witness against me before the Eternal and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose ass have I taken, or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith? And I'll restore it to you, saying, now am I guilty of anything at all? And they said, you have not defrauded, and so on. And he said, the Eternal is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they answered, he is witness. And Samuel said, it is the Eternal that advanced Moses and Aaron, and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now, therefore, stand still, that I may reason with you before the Eternal of all the righteous acts of the Eternal which he did to you and your fathers. And he began to recount those. Now in verse 13, now, therefore, behold the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And behold, the Eternal has set a king over you. And if you will fear the Eternal and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, God's laws, transcendent over those of the king, then shall both you and also the king that reigns over you continue following the Eternal your God. But if you will not obey the voice of the Eternal, but rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then shall the hand of the Eternal be against you as it was against your fathers. And so he began to explain that and to enlarge upon it, talked a little bit about the rain and the wheat harvest. Chapter 13, verse 1. Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel. Now the honeymoon was over. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was had in abomination with the Philistines, meaning they'd started a war, and so now the Philistines were going to retaliate. And the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered themselves together, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, That could be 66,000 because it could have been two per chariot, who knows. And people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. They were a gigantic group of people, far outnumbering the Israelites. And they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Beth Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, they hid in caves and thickets, rocks and high places, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead, as for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. So he had now unleashed a war by a little attack, almost like a commando raid, and all of a sudden, he is facing maybe several hundred thousand people, and frightened half to death, and thinking that he is going to lose his life and the kingdom. And Saul said, notice what happens here, bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offering. Now, it was explicitly prescribed that only the Levites could do this. Saul was now, because he was proud and because he was haughty and he was taller than all the other people and he was king, and after a little over a year, it had really gone to his head, even though originally he was hiding, trembling in the baggage for being shy and not being wanting to come out in front of the people and be coronated. He is now going to preempt what should have been the right of the Levites. He offered the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of the offering of the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. Saul went out to meet him that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattered from me, beginning to rationalize now, and excuse, and argue, and so on, that you came not within the days appointed, you're partially guilty, you're responsible for this, Samuel, you didn't show up, that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash, therefore, said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I've not made supplication to the Eternal. You can see how logical it sounds, Samuel, how right it sounds. You weren't here. I mean, the people were fleeing. We had to be reassured. We had to be in God's good graces. I forced myself, therefore. It was difficult for me. But I forced myself, I made myself offer a burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Eternal your God, which he commanded you. For now will the Eternal have established your kingdom upon Israel forever, and Saul would have been the beginning of a never-ending dynasty in place of the man we know who became the beginner of a never-ending dynasty, which is David. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Eternal has sought him a man after his own heart. And the Eternal has commanded him to be captain over his people because you have not kept that which the Eternal commanded you. So already, God, at the time Samuel is rebuking Saul, had selected David. Already had selected him. A man after God's own heart. Samuel arose and so on, and with him about 600 men. I won't belabor that. The 14th chapter is about Jonathan. They go out, they fight all day long. Saul makes one of the stupidest, dumbest decrees you can imagine out of nothing but vanity. In verse 24, the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eats any food until evening, that I may be avenged on my enemies. He was doing no fighting. But his army was out there fighting all day long with nothing to eat, nothing to drink. And in order to pompously posture that we will fast until I get satisfaction over my enemies, none of my army can eat or drink today. Well, Jonathan hadn't heard about it. And so when they were going through a wood, slew them on the ground and ate them with the blood. They got so hungry they just couldn't stand it. So they rebelled against the commandment. And they were going through a wood, and there were a lot of wild bees there, apparently, and they knocked them down, and it said that Jonathan put the stave of his spear in a honeycomb and picked it up and began to chew on it. And, of course, honey, you know, gives you a lot of quick energy and sugar. And so it really saved his life and brightened his eyes, as he said, and he felt a whole lot better, and they continued the battle. Well, they were going to find out who had brought this terrible evil upon them, and so he said, draw all the people hither, and the chief of the people, verse 38 of chapter 14, and let's see who did this terrible sin, who broke Saul's word about not eating from morning till night. For as the Eternal lives, which saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But there was not a man among all the people that answered him. Everybody just kept quiet because they knew who it was who had done it. Then he said to all Israel, you get on one side, and Jonathan and I will be on the other side. And the people said, do whatever seems good to you. So Saul said to the eternal God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And they cast maybe lots, whatever it was, like dice or what. Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son, and Jonathan was taken. And Saul said, what have you done? And Jonathan told him, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, and lo, according to your decree, I've got to die. You, my father, have got to put me to death. And Saul answered, God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. And the people said unto Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid. As the Eternal lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground. For he has wrought with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, that he died not. Now, originally, if you go back a little further, you will find that the people chose Saul. Saul was a populist. Saul catered to the whims of the people. Saul made decisions that would be popular with the people. Saul postured before the people. In one sense of the word, you see a little bit of early democracy here rearing its head, because the people said, we're not going to allow the greatest champion of the army and your own son to be put to death when some of us are guilty too, and they wouldn't come forward and volunteer just who it was who was guilty. And Saul, because he was afraid of the people, and because the people were the source of his power, gave in. You see, at no time was Almighty God Saul's ultimate authority. The people were Saul's authority. Saul was popular with the people. He wanted to be popular with the people and to do the popular thing. The base of his authority and his support were the people. He was not loyal to God, but loyal to the people, and so the people could call the shots. And so his decree wasn't really worth the breath that it took to speak it, or the paper it was written on, and he changed it. And Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all of his enemies on every side, verse 47, Moab and Ammon, and against Edom and the kings of Zoab, against the Philistines, and wherever he turned himself, he vexed them and gathered an host and smote the Amalekites and so on. Now, he goes down to kill some of the Amalekites. Chapter 15 is the story of that. And they were told in verse 3 to utterly destroy them and to spare them not because of their horrifying infant sacrifices and so on. Man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. And Saul gathered the people together, numbered them in Telaim, about 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. I won't read it all, but he came to a city, and he did smite them. But he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and killed all the rest of the people. But the people who followed him, because already they're seeing the way the wind blows under Saul's administration, chose the very best of the sheep and of the oxen, verse 9, of the fatlings and of the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly. Then came the word of the Eternal unto Samuel, saying, it repents me that I have set up Saul to be king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto the Eternal all night. And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul comes to Carmel, and behold, he set him up a place, and has gone about and passed on and gone down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said, blessed be thou the Eternal, I have performed the commandment of the Eternal. Always he forced himself. He did that which was right. He always justified what he had done. And Samuel said, well, then what's the meaning of this bleating of sheep and the lowing of oxen, which I hear, if you've done that which the Eternal said? And Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Eternal of God, or the Eternal thy God, and the rest we've utterly destroyed. Then Samuel said unto Saul, stay, and I will tell you what the Eternal has said to me this night. And he said, say on. And Samuel said, when you were little in your own sight, were you not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Eternal anointed you king over Israel? And the Eternal sent you on a journey and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore did you then not obey the voice of the Eternal, but did fly upon the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Eternal? But Saul argued, and he said to Samuel, "Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal, and have gone the way which the Eternal sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, they did it. They took the spoil, the sheep and the oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed. But they only did it to sacrifice to God. They did it for a good purpose. There's a logical reason why we didn't obey God here." And Samuel then, and here's one of our favorite scriptures of old, said, "Has the Eternal as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft," as if you had a weird collection of bats' wings and frogs' knuckles and were muttering strange incantations over them in the light of the moon, having a seance or involving yourself in Satan worship. "Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Eternal, he has also rejected you from being king." And Saul said unto Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Eternal in your words, because," and he admitted it himself, "I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, I pray thee, pardon my sin and turn again with me, that I may worship the Eternal." Now you can go on and on and on about the character of Saul, that he was willing to compromise, that he would shade the truth, that he was an opportunist, that he let ego and vanity creep in, that he began to look to the people as his base of support and power, and that he was a populist, wanted to do the popular and the expedient thing, not what God said. But now we come to the 16th chapter. We've already learned that back here, some weeks previously, Samuel told Saul he had already rejected Saul and had already chosen a man after God's own heart. Now we read about the choosing of David in the 16th chapter and how Jesse was calling all of his sons. In verse 7 we read how the Eternal said unto Samuel, "Look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Eternal sees not as a man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks on the heart." For a moment, let me just tell you about you and about me. First of all, let's talk about the straw man, that is, the spiritual straw man, that is, the perceived individual that you appear to be to your friends or your enemies alike. Each one of us has what I will call the ostensible personality. When you first meet someone, as you do a little bit every day, if you're in the general public, the best foot forward, the affable, friendly, likable, lovable, good Joe kind of a guy, or a nice girl, nice lady, convivial, hospitable, charming, warmth and humor, you know, how are you, well, you're a wonderful person, and on, people, because we like people to like us. And as we meet people, we put our best foot forward. Nothing wrong with that, that's not a sin. You don't want to put your worst foot forward, so to speak, or to show all your faults and all of your shortcomings and so on, the minute you meet someone. So you try to make a good impression. Oftentimes, in the broadest circle of people whom you might call acquaintances, that's about all they ever get to know about you, and first impressions are oftentimes the most important. And they will carry those impressions of you in their minds from now on. I remember cases where I had a horrible impression of a person a time or two. Sometimes I've been right, sometimes I've been wrong. One time in San Diego, back in about 1956, I was preaching a sermon. There was a fellow sitting back there that looked like he wanted to kill me. I thought, I've got to talk to this gentleman and find out what in the world is going on. I went back there and I found out one of the nicest guys I ever met. His face was just built like an upside-down dolphin. He had a built-in scowl. He just had one of these faces that had a built-in grimace on it. And it wasn't that he was grimacing at me. He couldn't help it. When he smiled, it was not quite a full smile. It was just one of these guys that had his face built that way. So sometimes a first impression can be wrong. But when we meet people that we want them to like us, it's kind of like being in traffic, and you just shift, you know, very smoothly from low in a second and then on into high, and you smoothly change gears from one level of acquaintanceship to the next, You become in a circle of certain friends at dinner parties, card games, maybe board games around dinner at your home, a circle of acquaintances, the social personality. The individual who is a little better known, now you get to the level of telling jokes, telling your experiences, talking about likes and dislikes, talking about the daily news, talking about other friends or whatever, and we talk about your social circle. And that's a different level of awareness at people who think they know you, but they still don't know you. They don't know you at all. Don't know you at all. Then there is that vulnerable personality that is a part of all of us. I was amazed the other day when on one of these morning game shows they had 10 half-naked male dancers, all of whom had fantastic upper arms and chests and so on, and they were there giving answers to various questions in this card game, kind of a game show. And they were asked the question, out of these male dancers who perform in these nightclubs for women, who were in there screaming and yelling and tucking $10 bills in the male dancers' very brief little briefs, and here they are up there with practically nothing on but a G-string doing these dances for women, and there are lots of places like that apparently. This was out in L.A. somewhere. How many of these 10 male dancers in a survey said they were basically a shy person? If this girl guessed how many, she would win a truck and a lot of money. So she went over and she put one. She thought there might be one of them or standing there half naked. I mean, chest and arms and everything exposed, and her dancing with nothing but a little G-string on. How in the world could a person who does that be shy? One. I thought she was wrong. I thought none. I would have guessed none of them. Come on. It lit up number seven. Seven of them said that they were basically a shy person. Now, I don't know how in the world they rationalize that, but let me tell you something that is going to really strain your credulity to the absolute breaking point, and it is the truth. My father, Herbert W. Armstrong, was a very shy person. See Ron Dart nodding his head? Because he knew him very well. I knew him very, very well. Most people would never remotely suspect a personality like my dad to be shy, but he was. He was not able to relate to the people in the church because basically he was shy. He was inside himself very much. You could talk to him, you could see his eyes tune you out, he'd be thinking about something over here. I mean, he was not a social animal, so they say. I mean, he just was not well adapted or adjusted socially. He was a vulnerable personality. There are people who confide in only a very tight circle of a few friends or only one very close friend and who will rarely really reveal themselves the way they feel about things deeply except to maybe one person. This is a totally different level of understanding this person than the ostensible personality or the social personality. This is the vulnerable personality. Then beyond that, there is the real you, the private person, the personal ego with all of your motives and drives and frustrations and desires, the habits, the true self that you know better than anyone except your spouse. Sometimes your spouse knows you better than you do. And then deep down, even inside of that, is the real you, which is the one God knows. And He knows you even better than you are willing to know yourself. Now, because David prayed in the way he did in the 51st Psalm some years later, and because he prayed on one occasion, "Search me and try me, O Eternal, and see if there be any evil thing in me, and lead me in the way of life everlasting." And when he said, "Wash me, purge me, scrub me with hyssop, and I shall be clean and whiter than snow," and prayed for forgiveness and so on, what I want to close by telling you about is that David had already been chosen as king before Samuel ever laid eyes on him. Now let's look at what occurred here, because Jesse leads these beautiful, big, tall, stalwart sons by, and when Eliab came, it came to pass that he, that is Samuel, looked on Eliab and said, "Surely the Eternal's anointed is before him." Wow, what a handsome young man. Here was Jesse's oldest, tallest, best-looking son. And the Eternal said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, nor on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Eternal sees not as man seeth, but man looks on the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. Ugly name, but a handsome kid. And he said, neither has the Eternal chosen this. Didn't mean to be a slight, you know, this or that. He meant him, you know, not trying to be ugly here. Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by, and he said, neither has the Eternal chosen this, meaning this one. Again, Jesse made seven of his sons to pass before Samuel, and it never occurred to Jesse that the little stripling, the youngest lad, Red, they might have called him, the ruddy redhead, out there keeping a sheep, because he's pretty smelly, I guess, out there keeping those sheep, would have been fit to pass before Samuel. And he was told, the Eternal has not chosen these. And Samuel said unto Jesse, are these all your children? And he said, there remains yet the youngest, and behold, he keeps the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, stand and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he come hither. And he was sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy. If you look at the margin, it means red-headed. Literally means that, apparently, reddish or rusty, haired or complexion. And withal of a beautiful countenance. And the margin seems to imply that it really meant having handsome eyes, is the Hebrew expression. And goodly to look to. So they were all real good-looking young men, but he was just younger than the rest of them and apparently smaller in stature. The Eternal said, arise and anoint him, for this is he. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. And it's interesting that at the anointing, the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward, that here, from the hand of God's prophet and a vial of oil, the Spirit of God, not in the way that he was begotten of God as we can be this side of Jesus Christ, but the Spirit, which is actually the Spirit of the one that we became familiar with as Jesus Christ, came upon David and was with him and influencing his mind and to protect him and inspire him from that day forward. And so Samuel rose up and went to Ramah, but the Spirit of the Eternal departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Eternal troubled him. Now, if you understand what that means, you look in the margin, it really means a sad or a depression or a melancholy spirit which God allowed to come over him. Not that it was a demon necessarily, although later on it does appear that demons did begin to torment Saul. But God's Spirit departed from him. So now he was just out there naked and vulnerable and no longer protected of God's angels or of God's Spirit, and God's Spirit was on and about David. So Saul, verse 17, after they'd suggested, why don't we get a cunning player on a harp who, when this evil spirit is upon you, he'll play and it'll help you and change your attitude, he said, provide me a man that can play well, in verse 17. Then his servants answered and said, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, that is, and listen to these qualifications, cunning in playing, so he was skilled on the harp, a mighty valiant man, so he was courageous and strong, a man of war, and prudent in matters, a comely person, and the Eternal is with him. Now, I won't go on with this because it's going to drag on a little too long, but I want to merely emphasize that at the time then he is introduced to Saul, the next chapter, the Philistines are terrifying Israel. Goliath is 6 cubits and a span, or apparently approximately 12 feet tall, and he is asking for a champion to come out and fight him. You'll read in verse 9 and 10, and then how David chose the smooth stones at a brook and went out to fight the Philistine. Notice in verse 24, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. So they're looking at the physical stature of the man, and they're terrified. And David goes out, and we know the story of David slaying Goliath, beheading him with his own big two-handed sword, taking his head to Saul, and keeping his armor, which he had for years later on. After that, the women began to sing and dance, chapter 18, verses 6 and 7, in the cities of Israel, and with tabrets and with joy and instruments of music, singing and dancing and saying as they played with a lilting kind of a song that they put together, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. So Saul was very wroth and, of course, began to try to kill David. Verse 14, it says, David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Eternal was with him. And he went before Saul when he was about to fight the giant and said, I killed both a bear and a lion, and told exactly how he had done it. What's the point of all of this? The point is, David didn't qualify to be a king until he was anointed king. The point is that David qualified to be the best sheepherder in the land. That David qualified to be the best son Jesse had. That David qualified to be a courageous, valiant, honest, trustworthy, faithful, God-fearing sheepherder. And that's why he became king. And so my message to you is that I don't care what your calling in life is. It probably isn't as lowly as standing out in the pastures herding sheep. And that wherever you are, if you become the best you can be in everything you do, whether you're a day laborer or a concrete finisher or a mother of children and a housewife, you don't have to have concepts of ruling over your pots and pans, or concepts of how to be a governor or a ruler or solve acid rain or tackle the problems of government. But if you have character, if you have love for God and love for your neighbor and love for God's people, if you have all of these qualities of 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, and any housewife can have those, easy to be entreated, kind, patient, long-suffering. What's that remind you of a cabinet-level officer? What's that got to do with a doctor of law from Harvard? What's that got to do with George Bush or John Tower? You can have all those qualifications right where you are, in your own home, male or female. And those qualifications are what will eventually make you a king.